You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Job. Job 32 through 37 will be the text that Pastor Sandy covers today.
Verse 34, men of understanding say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge, his words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Now, in one sense, he's no different than Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Job's calamity was caused by some sin in his life. This is what Elihu is saying to him. But here's where Elihu differs from Eliphaz. He says, Job, you've sinned twice. You sinned the first time, and that brought on this calamity. But since then, you've also sinned in how you've responded to this calamity. Elihu was wrong in the first accusation, but he was right in how Job had responded. He had sinned in his response to all this calamity. He was right in that. In essence, he was saying to Job, you've gone too far in trying to vindicate yourself. In essence, he's saying, even if Job had done everything right, Job's innocence didn't make God guilty. Here's what Job was doing. I'm trying to simplify it. Job was trying to make God look bad so he could look good. You ever talk to people like that? They try to make other people look bad so that they can look good. That's basically what Job was doing toward the end of that dialogue, trying to make God look bad so he could look good. Eliphaz points this out to Job. This is wrong. Again, Eliphaz was trapped in this restrictive theology. To him, when bad stuff happened, it meant that God had failed or man had sinned, so Job had sinned. But Job was just as trapped in his theology, for he had erred on the other side. Since he hadn't sinned, Job had concluded that God had failed, and that too was wrong. Elihu points out that the real tragedy in Job's life was not the loss of his wealth or his health or his status or even his family, but Job lost the fear of God. He lost the fear of God. And that's the thing you don't want to lose. You can lose everything else as long as you have the fear of God. But if you lose the fear of God, that's not good. When we experience pain, we can make a lot of statements that we really don't mean.
What does God want to make my life so miserable?
What are we doing? We're accusing God. We need to be careful.
I feel like God has forsaken me. Why doesn't he ever answer my prayers? I'm just doing something good for God. Why did he let this happen? If this is how God is going to treat me, why even am I a Christian?
Be careful what you say. Don't accuse God. You know, after the death of his beloved wife, C.S. Lewis wrote in his journal, not that I am in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there is no God after all, but, so this is what God's really like? Deceive yourself no longer. In other words, Lewis's pain was casting doubt on God's goodness. And this was Job. His confusion and his hurt almost suffocated his faith. Almost. Joe Bailey was a prolific Christian author. He died as the president of David C. Cook, a publisher of Sunday school curriculum. During his lifetime, Joe Bailey and his wife, they suffered greatly. They buried three of their kids, one at 18 days old after an unsuccessful surgery, one at 5 years old after leukemia, one at 18 years old after a sledding accident. Joe experienced his share of pain. And yet Joe had a saying that he lived by. It went like this. Remember in the darkness what you have learned in the light. Remember in the darkness what you have learned in the light. You know when the lights go off? You know when it gets dark in our lives? And we all go through those dark spots, don't we? We all go through those dark places, those lonely times when God seems hidden, when God remains silent. When we're in the dark, we can think things, we can say things that are not true. We can get ourselves in a lot of trouble. That's why we need to, when we're in the dark, we need to remember what we've learned in the light. When the lights go out, don't forget what you've learned about God. Remember who God is, even when you're in a dark place. Don't forget that. Chapter 35. Moreover, Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned?" You know, Job had drawn some rash conclusions. He claimed that it made no difference what kind of life a man lived. What did it matter if a man lived a righteous life or a wicked life? Again, he was speaking from his pain. In Job's life, the reward had been identical. He had been righteous, and look what he got for it. You see, Job's perspective was so cloudy, and yet he spoke with such certainty. Be careful you don't do that. You know, there's a time when you just got to say, wait a minute, I don't know, I don't understand. It's okay not to understand. It's okay not to know. You know, there's a verse in Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 29. It's one that I fall back on all the time. It says, the secret things belong unto the Lord our God. And there are some things that only God knows. See, here's the problem with Job. There's no longer any humility in his heart. He has gotten way too full of himself. This is what pain will do to you. Elihu continues, "I will answer you and your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see, and behold the clouds. They are higher than you." And from the rest of his speech, we assume that Elihu is pointing now to some real clouds that are forming on the horizon. Some storm clouds are gathering in the heavens, off in the distance. He says, "If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness a son of man. Because of the multitude of oppressions, they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the mighty." Elihu is saying that the impact of a man's wickedness or righteousness affects more than just that man. It affects the people around him. It affects God. Verse 10, "But no one says, where is God my maker? Who gives songs in the night?" Notice this, I love this. Notice God does speak to us. God is never totally silent. For even in the dark, even in the night of life, even when the sun doesn't shine, and you lay in your bed tossing and turning, waiting for the break of day, even in those times, God gives songs in the night. Don't you like that? Even in those times, the Spirit of God sings of His grace. Even in the dark place, He gives songs in the night. Just because God is quiet or God seems hidden, don't believe that He's absent. For He's not. He is still with you. You know, at our house, we have a night light in the hallway. It doesn't give off a lot of light. It wouldn't illuminate a parking lot. But if someone gets up in the middle of the night and has to maneuver around the house, it's enough light to kind of help them move around where they don't have to flip all the lights on and wake everybody else up. And God also gives to His people these little night lights. You know, just because you're in a dark place, don't believe that the sun no longer shines. It's shining somewhere. God still loves you. God is still in control. And He will communicate it in gentle and in subtle ways. He'll give you songs in the night, little night lights to help you get through. He says, "Who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven." I mean, obviously, God is our teacher. "And there they are. There they cry out, but He does not answer because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it. Although you say you do not see him, yet justice is before him, and you must wait for him. And now, because he has not punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. Job has been challenging God to speak. He should be thankful that God has not punished him for those challenges. You know, Job wants God to speak, but he's not willing to wait on God, and that's a problem. Job has become impatient. Job has filled the air with empty talk and with words without knowledge. And Elihu is fulfilling an important function in God's plan. If God appeared at that moment, Job wouldn't be able to digest what God would say to him. For Job's heart has become hard and his mind has become closed. And that's why Elihu is challenging some of his thinking. And he's preparing Job for God's visit in chapter 38. Chapter 36, Elihu also proceeded and said, "Bear with me a little, and I will show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf." Job was so busy defending his own character. Elihu's saying, "Wait a minute, there's some things that need to be said on God's behalf here. I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." And that's a little arrogant on Elihu's part. He sounds like the young man fresh out of Bible college. "Listen to me. I'm going to fetch knowledge from a distance. Don't forget, the one who has perfect knowledge is with you, Job." Boy, oh boy. Elihu is a bit of a know-it-all. "Behold, God is mighty, but despises no one. He is mighty in strength of understanding." In other words, God hasn't picked you out, Job, to be his whipping boy. God despises no one. God loves everyone. He wants the best for all of us. Elihu goes on to describe the righteous reign of God. He says he does not preserve the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but they are on the throne with kings. For he has seated them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in fetters, held in the courts of affliction, then he tells them their work and their transgressions, that they have acted defiantly. Elihu addresses a major issue on Job's mind. God doesn't punish without an explanation. He tells us what we've done wrong. Elihu is correct in this. The issue with Job was not some wrongdoing. His suffering was not some punishment. It was an opportunity to glorify God. Job just didn't see it. He says God also opens their ear to instruction, and he commands that they turn from iniquity. If they obey and serve him, they will spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasure. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword, and they shall die without knowledge. And that is an example of kindergarten theology. It's a classic example. And is that true? Sometimes, but not all the time. In verse 13, Elihu talks about God's judgment on the hypocrites. But then he numbers Job among them. That's a bad thing. Verse 16, "Indeed, he would have brought you out of dire distress into a broad place where there is no restraint, and what is set on your table would be full of riches. But you are filled with the judgment due to the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold of you, because there is wrath. Beware lest he take you away with one blow, for a large ransom would not help you avoid it. Will your riches or all the mighty forces keep you from distress? Do not desire the night when people are cut off in their place." In some ways, to me, Elihu is a great disappointment. Yes, he fears God and he upholds righteousness, but in places, he reverts back to the same kind of torturous comments that Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar had made toward Job. He kind of falls right back into that trap of that kindergarten theology. And here's a great example. He's just accusing him of some sin in his life, you know. Verse 21, "Take heed, do not turn to iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction. Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches like him? Who has assigned him his way? Or who has said, 'You have done wrong'? Remember to magnify his work of which men have sung. Everyone has seen it. Man looks on it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we do not know him. nor can the number of his years be discovered. Job needs this encouragement. He needs to get his eyes off his pain and back onto God. You know, he's been so fixated on the what he's endured and the why he can't explain that he's forgotten the who that he loves and the who that loves him. And that's the problem. Sometimes we miss it by one little letter. We need to change the why, the W-H-Y, to an O. We need to change the why to a who. That's what's going to happen at the end of this story. You know, so much of God is a mystery. And let's remember what we know. Let's remember what we don't know. Verse 27. For he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the midst, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Indeed, can anyone understand the spreading of clouds, the thunder from his canopy? And here Elihu, he marvels at nature's hydrological system, how water turns to gas and evaporates, and then it distills into rain. As hot and cold air collide, thunder shakes the canopy of the heavens. There's such beauty in a storm. He says, look, he scatters his light upon it, and he covers the depths of the sea. And as he's talking about a storm, we take it that an actual thunderstorm must have been brewing at this very moment. Job doesn't know it yet, but God is riding on this storm that's coming toward them. And he is going to appear to Job in chapter 38 in the whirlwind, or in this storm that's now starting to brew. God is going to speak to Job from the storm. He says, for by these thunderstorms, he judges the people. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with lightning and commands it to strike. His thunder declares it, the cattle also, concerning the rising storm. Chapter 37. At this also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He sends it forth under the whole heaven, his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars, his thunders with its majestic voice, and he does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which we cannot comprehend. God has some things to say to Job from the storm. For he says to the snow, fall on the earth, likewise to the gentle rain and the heavy hand rain of his strength. He seals the hand of every man, that all men may know his work. You know, I love a southern snowstorm. We're told that when he sends the storm, he seals the hand of every man, that all men may know his work. I love a southern snowstorm. You know, Atlanta is such a fast-paced city, such a busy place, busy people with can't-wait projects, with can't-miss appointments. We're all running. We're all so important. The things we do are so important. And yet, in a few hours, God dumps a couple of inches of snow in the city. And what happens? All life comes to a screeching halt. You can't get your car out of the driveway. And guess what happens? Guess what happens? Well, you get over your frustration, and you get over your powerlessness and your feeling of impotence and your feeling of, this is out of my control. You get over all that, and then what do? Well, you play with your kids. You go outside and you throw snowballs and you build a snowman. And then you sit with your family by a fire in a fireplace to try to stay warm. And you spend a little time with your spouse. And your wife gets a cup of hot chocolate. And you're sitting there with her and she's reading a book. And you're playing in the snow. And what happens? In a few hours, God forces the whole city to revisit their priorities. And he puts life back in perspective. And he shows us what's really important. And he can do that with just a couple of inches of white stuff. It's amazing. It's still September, but let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Verse 8, the beasts go into dens and remain in their lairs. Elihu explains how God sends the animals into their winter hibernation. And from the chamber of the south comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds of the north. Storms result from the colliding of air masses. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen. Also with moisture, he saturates the thick clouds. He scatters his bright clouds, and they swirl about, being turned by his guidance, that they may do whatever he commands them on the face of the whole earth. You know, even in the light of the science of meteorology, wind is still a mysterious force. No one understands the wind. And with all of the computer models available to us, did you notice a few months ago? With all of the computer models and all of the science and all of the meteorologists available to us, they still can't determine the path of a hurricane. They can't. Why? Here we're told, because the wind swirls, being turned by God's guidance, that they may do whatever he commands them on the face of the whole earth. God causes the storms to come, whether for correction or for his land or for mercy. That's interesting. There's three reasons God sends a storm. Storms can punish, storms can water, and storms can bless. Verse 14, listen to this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches them and causes the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know how the clouds are balanced, those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? Why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth by the south wind? The Mediterranean breezes would blow in and they would cool the land of Uz. And when the breeze stopped blowing off the Mediterranean, the desert heat would rise and their garments would get hot. And he's saying, Job, do you know how all this works? He's trying to humble Job. With God, have you spread out the skies strong as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we should say to him, for we can prepare nothing because of the darkness. Should he be told that I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Job has demanded an audience before God to plead his case. But Elihu doubts if a fragile Job would fare very well in the presence of the Almighty. He says, even now, men cannot look at the light when it is bright in the skies. And the sun can be so blinding. When the wind has passed and cleared them, he comes from the north as golden splendor. With God is awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is excellent in power, in judgment, and abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear him. And it's as if Elihu is asking, Job, do you still fear God? Job, you've become very proud, very, very haughty. Job, do you still fear God? Remember, you can lose your wealth. You can lose your health. You can lose your family. There are a lot of things you can lose, but the one thing you don't want to lose in this life is the fear of God. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. God is about to appear to Job. He's coming on the clouds. He's going to appear to Job in a world, in this storm that's been brewing and that Elihu has been describing. And sparks are going to fly in chapter 38. You know, later, God will restore Job, and he will rebuke Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. It's interesting, though, that Elihu isn't mentioned in God's rebuke. Though his words weren't perfect, they did serve God's purpose in Job's life. Elihu got Job's eyes off of himself and back onto God. He restored for Job some perspective. He restored some reverence for God and some humility for himself, and that was important. Now that Elihu's done, Job is ready. Well, as ready as he can be for what is about to happen in chapter 38.
In the years of plenty, Job praised God and thanked him for everything. In the years of heartache and pain, Job worshiped and submitted to God's will, never once denying his existence. No matter the temptation, Job never stepped away from his faith and his Creator, always revering the Lord as he endured the trial. Are you enduring a trial right now? Be comforted by Job's story. God never left Job's side, and he will never leave yours. He is your strength and comfort in this situation. Though you may not be able to see it, your trial is making you stronger and drawing you closer to your Creator. Don't let the enemy win. Cling to God and let Him work in you. May we pray for you as you go through this difficult time? Please feel free to call us here at Sandy Adams Radio. Our number is 770-736-2828. Let us know how we can be covering you in prayer. That number again is 770-736-2828. We'd also like to encourage you to get involved in a local church if you haven't already. This is a place you can be real and raw and find support from your brothers and sisters in Christ. If you're in Atlanta, we'd love to have you join us at Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain. We meet weekly on Sundays and Wednesdays. You'll find more information at sandyadams.org. Thanks for tuning in today. We hope you'll join us again right here on Sandy Adams Radio.